We'll move now from the intellectual to the historical. Paul Shaviv, of course, is the director of education at Tannenbaum Chat, where I have the pleasure of teaching. So on Tuesday, I get back into the in the day-to-day grind. And he actually wrote last year, which is really the classic book, I think the only book in the field, on how to run a Jewish school, which is, he spent a number of years. But the other side of Paul Shaviv, he did his master's thesis on in Oxford on the conflict in the Old Yeshuv, dealing with Rav Kook and the Old Yeshuv, and that's for that reason we invited him to speak on this topic this morning, and it's a pleasure to have him and take over.
Thank you very much, Jay. I will a little bit over. A little bit over is good. All right, I'll try not to go too much over. First of all, I want to thank Jay and Elliot again for inviting me to speak again at Torah in Motion. I want to talk about the conflict between Rav Kook and the Old Yeshuv, or the community of, more accurately, the community of the Old Yeshuv of Jerusalem. And there are two ways of approaching this, and this in a way complements Professor Diamond's comments. One is to go through a detailed chronological record of a depressing litany of mutual insults and conflict and incidents and good and here and here they, this one was a sun deck at the Bris and this one stood by and offered wine, etc., whatever. But I, first of all, before I want to touch on some of those fascinating stories of which feature greatly in Jerusalem folklore, I want to take a slightly different tack, which is really very well complements Professor Diamond's comments, and look at the conceptual and the ideological basis for the conflict, because that is really what it is about. And this conflict between Rav Kook, both individually and what he represented, and the community of the that we call the Old Yeshuv of Jerusalem, which I'll talk about in a moment, is really encapsulates and in a way is an exemplar of the major conflict of post-emancipation Jewry, on a personal level, between one of the towering giants of orthodoxy in the 19th and 20th century, Rav Kook, and the early community of non-Zionist and anti-Zionist Orthodox in Jerusalem, a conflict which continues until this very day. So let us define terms, first of all. Who are we talking about? Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Kook was born in Griva in Lithuania in 1865. He studied in the yeshiva of Volozhin, where he was an outstanding student. He married the daughter of the Aderet, Rabbi David Rabinovitz Ta'omim, known as the Aderet, which immediately gave him a close relationship to the Jerusalem community. The Aderet was designated to be the successor to Reb Shmuel Salant as the Rav of Jerusalem in the 19th century. He unfortunately predeceased Rav Salant. I'll talk about it in a couple of minutes. But Rav Kook married his daughter. Rav Kook served for a time as Rav in two cities in Lithuania, in Boisk and in Zemel. And in 1904, he made aliyah, as they would say nowadays. He went to Israel to accept the appointment as the Rav of Jaffa, but not just Jaffa. I have in my small collection some examples of his notepaper where he is Rav of Jaffa v'Hamoshavot. He is Rav of Jaffa and the colonies, it says in English. In other words, this was the period of the second Aliyah. Jaffa was one of the centers, if not the center at that time, in the very early time of the second Aliyah, of the leadership of the Zionist movement, of the pioneers and the settlers. And to be Rav of Jaffa was really quite an important appointment. You have to understand that and again, my tack on this is the historical perspective, not the philosophical, whatever, but the historical perspective. The second Aliyah avoided Jerusalem. There was virtually no Olim, no Chalutzim, no pioneers who went to Jerusalem at that time. It was, and to a certain extent still is, regarded as somewhat extraterritorial to the Zionist enterprise. But on his arrival in Jaffa, Rav Kook immediately identified with, and more important, as Professor Diamond mentioned, he legitimized the Zionist settlers, the Zionist movement. And this was part of his apocalyptic vision of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the settlement of the land of Israel, as Atchalta de Geula, the beginnings of redemption. His famous, very famous marshal was of the Holy of Holies in the temple. When asked to justify how can you support all of these heretics and atheists and whatever, his famous marshal was that in the temple was the Holy of Holies. What did they do? You know, the entrance to the Holy of Holies was closely defined. Only the Kohen Gadol could go in on Yom Kippur, etc. But he said, what did they do? In a famous passage, he said, what did they do when the Holy of Holies needed to be painted? You know, when it needed to be repaired, when it needed to be painted. And the answer is, he said, they lowered workmen into the Holy of Holies from above, and they did the necessary repairs. He said, this is the function, exactly the same. The Holy of Holies is the land of Israel, and the Chalutzim, whoever they are, who are building it and repairing it, are equivalent to the workmen who repaired the Holy of Holies. His vision, which he never lost, the apocalyptic, the messianic vision of the rebuilding of the land of Israel and the Zionist movement as the beginnings of redemption, was reinforced by subsequent developments. And from a historical point of view, it's very important to understand for both sides, I'll come to the Old Yishuv in a moment, to both sides, the historical context here. Here was Rav Kook in 1904 with this vision of the land of Israel rebuilt. And 1904 was very early days, very, very early days. But in his lifetime, he saw World War I, the First World War, the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the Balfour Declaration, in 1917, the establishment of the British Mandate, the conquest of Jerusalem and of Israel by General Allenby at the end of the First World War, the establishment of the Yishuv, the establishment of the Vad Lumi, of the Jewish autonomous institutions in Palestine, as it then was. And all of this was for him the inexorable march of redemption, of steps leading to what actually was ultimately to happen, which was the establishment of an independent state after he died in 1948. And I do want to endorse what Professor Diamond says. It is a mistake to see Rav Kook as wholeheartedly an advocate of anything goes. He was actually, and this is the paradox, and this is in a way why the Old Yishuv was so vehemently troubled by his presence and by his personality, because he was one of them. He was one of them. He was a deeply, deeply, deeply learned religious personality, and although he had tolerance was not the same as approval. Well, that in three sentences is certainly the background to Rav Kook. But who or what was the Old Yishuv? The Old Yishuv is the term, as opposed to the New Yishuv, which is the Zionist settlement, the Zionist community. The Old Yishuv is the term used to describe the Jews who came to Israel or who lived in Israel before the Zionist Aliyot. Most of them, not all, but most of them centered in Jerusalem, and they were a non-Zionist and later an anti-Zionist community. A great deal of nonsense, is spoken and written about the Old Yishuv of Jerusalem, much of it under the Art Scroll imprint. Okay, that is my rant for today. Yeah? And the sort of thing that you read about the Old Yishuv is nonsense, such as these were communities of Jews who'd lived there for hundreds of years, peacefully, without any trouble with their Arab neighbors, and they'd lived there uninterrupted for hundreds of years, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. It is total nonsense. The old Yeshuv of Jerusalem were composed of three main groups, one Sephardi and two Ashkenazi. First of all, there was a Sephardi community in Jerusalem, which indeed had lived there for on and off for many hundreds of years, but it was relatively small. They were part of what we might call the Mediterranean or the Near Eastern Jewish community. They were a fairly wealthy, rather enlightened, somewhat aristocratic group of traders who had extensive contacts with other Sephardi communities in Turkey, in Egypt, in Syria, and in what was later to become Lebanon. They generally were modern. They sent their children to study in Paris and in Damascus and in Egypt, etc. The second group, the first of the two Ashkenazi groups, were the Ashkenazim who were in Jerusalem, who are known generally as the Talmidei HaGra, the students or the pupils or the followers of Vilna Gaon. And they really began emigration in the late 18th century, very end of the 18th century, and they were generally fairly moderate. I'll come on to some names. They were a somewhat small and somewhat, what's the word? I hesitate to use the word, but rather inbred sort of group. And they had some bizarre manifestations. The Jerusalem historian Ari Morgenstern has spoken and written about the astonishing developments around the year 1840. 1840 is 5,600 in the Jewish calendar, and the Jews of Jerusalem were convinced that this was going to be the year that the Messiah would come. And when the Messiah didn't come, several of them converted to Christianity through the Anglican mission in Jerusalem. And, right, yeah, someone said, what? Right, yeah. Yes. So you had in Morgenstern's book, Meshichiyot Be'eretz Yisrael, he shows the Pinkas, the minute book of the Bikur Cholim Hospital for 1840, where there's a list of the committee, and against two names of the committee, they're scratched out and Yimach Shemom written next to them. So, and part of the bizarre manifestations here, again, it's well documented. This group had very ambiguous and ambivalent relationships with some of the Christian institutions in Jerusalem. They lived in great poverty, etc., etc., etc. But a very interesting group of people, and their Rav, who was the Rav of Jerusalem for longer than Queen Victoria was on the throne of England, was Rav Shmuel Salant. We will come back to him. By the late 19th century, this group had counted among their members some rather enlightened people, David Yelin, Yechiel Michal Pines, and others, who were interested and connected to what was going on in Europe. You may know around the back of Geula is the B'nai B'rith Library, which was established at the end of the 19th century. I think it's now the offices of the RCA in Jerusalem. And the B'nai B'rith Library, which was also the focus of some controversy, was established by this group of rather enlightened Ashkenazim, Lithuanian Ashkenazim, to bring something of culture and education into Jerusalem. And so far, so good. However, who were the group that set the tone in the old Yeshuv? I spoke about the Talmidei HaGra, the Lithuanians, but suddenly the Hungarians arrived. I don't want to offend anyone here, but all the problems in Jerusalem come from the Hungarians. And they arrived, this group came to be dominant, and they were represented by the arrival in Jerusalem in 1877 of Reb Moshe Yehoshua Leib Diskin. He was the Rav of Brisk. He is not to be confused with any of the Soloveitchik Brisks or Briskers or any of that rather different crowd. He was simply the Rav of the town of Brisk in Lithuania. And he arrived, he lived from 1818 to 1898. He arrived in Jerusalem in 1877. He arrived accompanied by his second wife, Sonia, who figures greatly in the literature of the time. with a being called a list of names that long. She was apparently a very powerful personality. And he came for a very specific reason, and this is central to the understanding of the conflicts, subsequent conflicts in Jerusalem, and the emergence eventually of the Naturae Carta, not on our agenda today, but I've spoken about that at Torah Motion before. He came because he was fleeing the effects of the Enlightenment in Europe. And this process had begun with the French Revolution in 1789. Before 1789, Jewish communities throughout Europe, under the feudal system, had autonomy and they had their own internal authority. Without going into all the details, Jewish self-government was uniform in most, certainly Central and Eastern European Jewish communities before 1789. After 1789, the French Revolution, Jews became, the community lost its status. Jews became individual citizens of the countries in which they lived. And Judaism, being Jewish, became, as it is today, essentially a voluntary occupation. And this, of course, had profound effects on Jewish communities all over the place. The only person, perhaps, who really understood what was going on was Rabbi Moses Sofer, again, the subject of an earlier talk of mine to this group, who understood when the Hamburg Temple opened in 1819, and a little book of the Hamburg Beit Din invited rabbis from all over Europe to give their views and published in a book called Eile Divrei HaBrit, These Are the Words of the Covenant. All the respondents came up with numerous halachic reasons why the Hamburg Temple, the first purpose-built Reform synagogue in Europe, was treif, and you know, you can't play an organ on Shabbat because of this and that reason. The Chasam Sofer, in his response, said, forget all the arguments, the rules have been changed, the old rules don't apply anymore, and we will never convince these people by virtue of argument. And the Chasam Sofer had the brilliant, brilliant, brilliant historical insight in Hungary in the opening decades of the 19th century that one of the freedoms of the open society, was the freedom to withdraw from it. One of the freedoms of the open society was the option of saying, we don't want to be part of this. And he founded the doctrine of cultural self-isolation, which from then until this very day governs the conduct of the intensively Orthodox Haredi, as we call them today, Haredi communities. In Hungary, emancipation came a little later, and the Hungarian Revolution of 1848. I'm sorry to return to my customary rant, but if you read the Arscroll history of the world, you'll get the impression that Hungarian Orthodoxy was monolithic and pious and untainted, God forbid, by modernity. It's totally wrong. In 1868, the Hungarian community, in a bitter argument, split into three, into the Orthodox communities, into what were called the status quo communities, and into the Neolog, who are really conservative communities. And throughout all the struggles and wars of Orthodoxy the wars of adjustment, you might call them, in the 19th and 20th century, there are two main areas of conflict. And one of them is the question of authority. Who has authority in Jewish communities? Of course, the position of the intensively Orthodox was that Orthodoxy equals rabbinic authority, and no secular leadership, no non-rabbinic authority was to be countenanced. The second area, major area, there are many areas of conflict. The second major area of conflict was that of education. There were many, many battles over education. What was to be the education in Jewish institutions of learning? Was it or was it not to include foreign languages? Was it or was it not to include, and to what measure, non-Torah studies, what we would call general studies. And both of these were issues in Jerusalem at the time that the Brisk Rav, the Maharil Diskin, arrived in Jerusalem. He sought to bring the battles of Europe to Jerusalem. And of course, this was not entirely appropriate. Why did he come to Jerusalem, and why did he believe that in Jerusalem he would find a refuge from the battles that he and Orthodoxy were facing in Europe? Because, of course, Jerusalem was at the time under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And the Ottoman Empire was a pre-modern structure, which was not democratic, it was not enlightened. The Ottoman Empire feared enlightenment and revolution as much as the European powers did. And therefore, it was a very, very traditional community. And he believed that there he would find refuge. But there is an old English legend of King Canute. King Canute was an Anglo-Saxon king who, according to different versions of the legend, was an Anglo-Saxon king who, his followers, according to one version, his followers believed that he was omnipotent, that he could do anything. And they said, King, and he was a bit fed up with this, and they said, prove it, we know that if you told the sea to stop coming in, the tide to stop coming in, it would stop. And he was fed up, according, again, a different version of the legend, but he said, okay, you know, and I'll show you, I'll prove to you I'm not omnipotent. And they sat him on the throne on the seashore in Brighton or Margate or somewhere on the English south coast. And the tide was coming in, and he sat there with his hands like that until the water sort of reached his neck, and then he got up and went back in. You cannot stop the tide. And you have to understand, again, from a historical point of view, by the end of the 19th century, communications were different. You had railways, you had steamships, you had the telegraph, you had travel. People could move from place to place far more quickly and with greater ease than they ever could before. And the Enlightenment was beginning to arrive in Jerusalem. Plus, Enlightenment, commerce, etc. And one of the great sort of battles at the time was Moses Montefiore had donated, who was very concerned with the question of the livelihood of the Jews of Jerusalem. Montefiore was a fascinating guy. A major new biography of him, the first really serious biography, that was recently published 3 or 4 months ago. And he was very, very concerned about the livelihood of Jews in Jerusalem. Because as a Victorian entrepreneur, he visited Jerusalem 7 times, which in those days was an incredible journey. All of you know the Montefiore windmill in Yemin Moshe, which was there to, again, to encourage the Jews of Jerusalem to make their own livelihood. And part of his concern was that the young men in Jerusalem could not earn their livelihood. They were not really getting enough instruction. He donated money for the boys in the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim to receive instruction in Arabic. This was not long before Diskin arrived. And he declared war on this idea because the wars in Europe had been, many of them had been about education, about foreign languages. Foreign languages were seen as a vehicle of secularization and of new ideas. If you didn't speak modern European languages, you wouldn't, God forbid, read anything dangerous. You wouldn't read Mendelssohn, you wouldn't read this, you wouldn't read that. At the height of the war, the height of the battle over the teaching of Arabic in the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, Reb Shmuel Salant, the old Lithuanian chief rabbi of Jerusalem, made a statement that sums it all up. He was heard to he said, Jerusalem is not Berlin and Arabic is not German. In other words, Arabic was a traditional language. It was not at that time yet a vehicle for modernity. And the war between Diskin and Salant was very, very vicious. In David Yelin's autobiography, Yelin was an old Sephardi, came from an old Sephardi family in Jerusalem. He was put in cherem because he sent one of his children to study in Paris at a university. His chalukah, I won't go into the whole description of what chalukah was, but his stipend from communal funds was cut off. And he wrote a whole little memoir about this. And he describes there how one Shabbat morning, right? Diskin's yeshiva bacharim descended on the shul of Rav Salant in the old city of Jerusalem and broke it apart, stick by stick. Broke apart all of the furniture, threw the furniture out the windows, beat up the worshippers, etc., etc., etc. And not much changes. Diskin died in 1898. Note here again, the first Zionist Congress was in 1896, another sign that things were changing and moving. And his successor, who was to play a major role in the confrontation with Rav Kook, was Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, lived from 1848 to 1932. Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was an extraordinary man, a great leader, a very great scholar. And already now events were beginning to change very, very rapidly. And if you look at some of the change in events before the outbreak of the First World War, which for various reasons that I'll go into signaled a huge change in the whole balance of events in the old Yeshuv. First of all, following the Zionist Congress, Mizrahi and split from the, I think, the third or fourth Zionist Congress, and Agudat Israel was founded in Europe in 1912. At the same time, a Palestinian branch, as it was then called, of Aguda was founded in Jerusalem, headed by Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld and by another fascinating, fascinating figure whose real biography has not been written, Reb Moshe Bloy. Moshe Bloy's younger brother was Amram Bloy, who later was to achieve fame in another connection. Moshe Bloy was the secretary of the Palestinian Aguda, a very, very, very interesting man. Already then, before the First World War, the political balance was changing. The Second Aliyah had taken place. Even in Jerusalem itself, things were changing. As I mentioned before, the Second Aliyah avoided Jerusalem until the establishment of the first Zionist modern institution in Jerusalem, which was the Bezalel School of Art. The Bezalel School of Art was founded, I think, in 1906 by Boris Schatz. And there is a fabulous, fabulous memoir of old Jerusalem by Benzion Yadler. Benzion Yadler was the Maggid of Jerusalem, and anyone who reads Agnon will know in Agnon's novel about the old city, Tmol Shilshom, Reb Benzion Yadler is the character who's called Reb Yankel Grunem Pupik in that novel. Benzion Yadler was the Maggid of Jerusalem. He would stand up on every street corner. He would darshan by the kotel. He was guaranteed to go from, magnificent oratory to shaking tears, just at a flip. And he wrote a fascinating memoir of old Jerusalem called Al Chomotayich Yerushalayim. And there he describes the first time that the old Yeshuv understood, and because as you hear from what I'm saying, it wasn't really the old Yeshuv, it dated from the late 19th century, not hundreds of years of uninterrupted whatever. The first time the old Yeshuv understood how much things were changing was, as he writes, that when Bezalel was created, one Shabbat afternoon, a Bezalel student walked down a main street in Jerusalem wearing shorts, right? B'michnasayim k'tzarim, wearing shorts, selling what he describes as sarsaparilla. People of a certain age will know that sarsaparilla is an old European word for lemonade. Yeah? It's pop, you would say. And he walked down the main street of Jerusalem on a Shabbat afternoon with holding a tray where he had drinks for sale, and he called out Chetzi Grush LeBakbuk. And Ben Tzion Yadler says that at that moment, the Rabbonim of Jerusalem understood that Ivrit, modern Hebrew, had arrived in Jerusalem, that it was also not only a secular, but a secularizing medium. Because if you could call out on a Shabbat afternoon in Jerusalem that the pop is half a grush for a bottle, yeah, then already the use of language was changing. Until that point, the instruction in the yeshivot in Jerusalem in Eitz Chaim was in Ivrit, and at that point they changed it back to Yiddish. Because they realized that just as German had been a danger in Europe, Ivrit could be a danger in Jerusalem as well. Again, there were many issues already with Rav Kook before the First World War. Professor Diamond mentioned the 1913 tour of the settlements. That was actually, I'd like to take a slightly different take on it than Professor Diamond. It was organized by Ben Tzion Yadler, by the same Maggid of Jerusalem. Rav Kook was actually a very junior member of the settlement, of the expedition. But 13 rabbis, including Rav Kook and Rav Sonnenfeld, went in a wagon, in a cart, in an open cart, touring all the settlements, particularly mainly in the north, in the Galil in the north of Israel. Their task, actually their primary purpose, because this was Ben Tzion Yadler's thing, was the observance of the agricultural commandments, to encourage the settlements, the farmers, to be aware of the mitzvot hatzviot ba'aretz, the dinim concerning agricultural produce. But the diary of this whole trip was printed in Cathedra, periodical Cathedra, many years back. But there were still tensions, although they weren't so overt. The Haredim objected to Rav Kook's endorsement of the Tachamoni school in Jaffa, which taught not only foreign languages but secular subjects, etc. But really, their worlds did not overlap. Jaffa was Jaffa, Jerusalem was there with the wagons drawn around the city, and they didn't get, you know, they didn't clash so much. I'm reminded, you know, somebody once asked the late Alexander Schindler, who was the head of the American Reform Movement, how it was that he and the Satmar Rebbe, who lived only a few blocks away from him, how it was that in Jerusalem their followers were hurling stones and insults at each other all day, and in New York they lived in peace with each other. And Schindler said, you know why? He said, because in New York, me and the Satmar Rebbe never, ever have any need to meet each other or talk to each other. And it was the same with Rav Kook and the Haredim before the First World War. But then everything changed. Rav Kook in 1914 was on his way to Switzerland. He was on his way to Switzerland. Again, this is not something that you will find in the authorized art scroll biographies, but he was on his way to Switzerland as a delegate of Aguda in Palestine to the Agudat Israel World Conference that was being held in Switzerland in 1914. He was stranded by the outbreak of war, and he spent the entire war in London as the Rav of the Machzikei Hadass Synagogue. At the end of the war, everything had changed. From the Haredi, from the point of view of the old Yeshuv, here is a partial list. Number one, as I said before, the Ottoman Empire had collapsed. Number two, Palestine had been conquered by the British, who had imposed immediately, until the mandate, imposed military governance, OITA, on the Yeshuv. Number three, no less important, was the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution completely changed the whole power base of the old Yeshuv back in Europe. The funds stopped coming, etc., etc., etc. And also, you have to understand here that the First World War was a disaster for Jerusalem. It's reckoned that as many as 20 to 30% of the total Jewish population of Jerusalem died of malnutrition in the First World War. Huge, huge, huge percentage. Because their funds were cut off. The Ottoman Empire was, you know, the welfare of the inhabitants of Jerusalem was the last thing at that point on the concerns of the Ottoman Empire. And it was a time of severe, severe hardship. After the First World War, it's reckoned that a third of the Jerusalem Old Yeshuv population, of the intensively Orthodox population, emigrated. if you look at the history of America and of Britain and of South Africa and of Australia, you can enumerate the old generation of Klei Kodesh, rabbis, shochetim, chazanim, Hebrew teachers, who emigrated from Jerusalem between 1917 and 1920, and who arrived to serve as Klei Kodesh in these countries. A timely thing, many of you last night will have used the slichas of the so-called Reverend Rosenfeld. Yeah? Yes, who used the slichas of Reverend Rosenfeld slichas? Someone must have done. Anyway, maybe you use them without realizing it. Rosenfeld and his brother was a great example of that. He was a very learned Rav. In England, he was the Reverend. He was the chazan of the shul in London. But he was a great scholar, and he produced the Siddichus and the Kinnus in unparalleled scholarly editions. I was taught my bar mitzvah by his younger brother, Abraham Rosenfeld, Joseph Rosenfeld, who I was talking to somebody about this yesterday. He was the president, actually I was talking to Leon about it yesterday, at Shalashudas. He was the president of the Jewish Vegetarian Society in London. He was the Rav of the Shibul where I grew up, but he, somewhat paradoxically, he was a shochet by profession, which is a difficult double act. Anyway, but the whole balance of everything, their whole world, the Haredi world in Jerusalem, had been turned upside down. A third of them emigrated. A third of the Jerusalem Yeshuv, cut off their payers and went out to join the Zionist settlements and the Zionist new economic activity, because here you had, that was where the economic activity was. And a third of them stayed in the community of the old Yeshuv. At the end of the war, therefore, the Jerusalem community found itself in a huge economic and political dilemma. And Rav Kook was in London, and at that time, the two leading Ashkenazi institutions in Jerusalem were the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and the Bikur Cholim Hospital. Now Bikur Cholim is it's a hospital, but at that time it was a hospital and a social welfare agency as well. And traditionally, the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and the Bikur Cholim Hospital shared a Rav, and that Rav was recognized as the Rav of Jerusalem. So, after the war, the two Hanhalot, the two executives of these two institutions got together, and they said, you know, life has changed. Our funding, you know, our supporters in Russia and Eastern Europe can no longer send us funds. We need a figurehead who will be a draw for funding for our institutions. Who better than Rav Kook, who is sitting in London trying desperately to get back to Palestine? So they decided to issue an invitation to Rav Kook to be the Rav of, it was called by the initials Ach V'Bach, Eitz Chaim V'Bikur Cholim. He should come be the Rav of Jerusalem. So they sent an invitation to Rav Kook. It is well documented that the Jerusalem post office at that time, i.e. where the telegraphs used to be sent from, was, you know, most of the clerks, most of the pekidim were from the old Yeshuv. They were, you know, old, you know, Jews with payers' beards. So they knew that if they sent the telegraph from Jerusalem, it would be leaked immediately, right? Whichever telegraph operator would send the telegraph would immediately run back to, you know, Batai Ungarn, back to the Hungarian and say, oh, you know what? So they sent sent a messenger to Hebron to send it from the Hebron post office, which was staffed entirely by Arabs, and the news wouldn't leak. So suddenly it became known that Rav Kook was about to arrive in Jerusalem. Consider here the implications of this. Here was Rav Kook, as Professor Diamond pointed out, someone who, in his ideology and theology, legitimized the thing that the old Yeshuv feared most, which was a transfer of authority from rabbinic authority to democratic, for want of a better word, secular authority. He used to be in Jaffa. Now he was coming to live in Jerusalem with the title, the de facto title of the Rav of Jerusalem. So, and they did not know that he was going to arrive until more or less the day that his ship docked. And a delegation went out to meet him in Motsar, just on the outskirts of Jerusalem, when he came from Jaffa. And a delegation brought him to the house of Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, where he was forced to agree that he would act only as the Rav of the institutions and not accept the title that generally went with it as the Rav of Jerusalem. But the situation was even more dire than that, because the Palestinian Aguda under Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld and the community they represented had to understand that the fight for authority was over. They could no longer persuade the Ottomans or lobby the Ottoman Empire to say, we are the true representatives of the Jews of Palestine. You want to keep your distance from these new Zionist settlers because they are revolutionaries and they will upset the Ottoman Empire just as much as they are upsetting us. So the fight for authority was over because the British were not interested in them. The British had an alliance with the Jewish Agency and the World Zionist Organization, as it then was, for their own strategic purposes. And therefore, the objectives of the Haredi community became twofold. Number one, to maintain their community privileges, their own shechita. It became a very violent issue. To maintain their own batai din, a very contentious issue, as we will see in a moment. And secondly, they tried for, throughout the mandate, basically until 1933, as a strategic objective to try and get the British government and the mandate, and ultimately the League of Nations, to recognize Jerusalem as an independent political enclave. Yeah, we are not part of mandatory Palestine. There is mandatory Palestine for the modern settlers, and there is Jerusalem, which is an autonomous state within a state within a state. Something you see in the Tory Carter carried on this theme up to the present day. Technically, what they wanted was independence from the Vat Lumi, from the National Council of Jewish Settlers in Palestine. The British only had limited tolerance for this, because the British, following the Balfour Declaration, again, at least initially, they saw the Zionist movement and the support for a Jewish national home primarily as a counterweight to French colonial influence in the region, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, etc. And of course, the Zionist movement itself, the Jewish Agency, had even less tolerance for them, particularly when they tried to extend their lobbying way beyond the confines of the British Mandate and started petitioning the League of Nations. They enlisted for a period the energies of the very exotic character, Dr. Jacob de Haan, a originally Dutch journalist who became very close to Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who was a correspondent for various Dutch and then English newspapers, and who wrote very polemic articles reporting from Jerusalem, and one of the great scandals and cause célèbre of the history of the Yishuv. He was assassinated in 1924, certainly by the Haganah. But that is a fascinating story, but it's outside our subject. Rav Kook, Jewish, a Baal Teshuva. I mentioned the word exotic. You may interpret that as you wish, but it is a fact that despite the fact that he was, he is publicly regarded as a great martyr for the Haredi cause, there is not a single Haredi institution named after him. Yeah, and Vahamevin Yovin, yeah? So, here you have Rav Kook in Jerusalem. He sees whatever his relationships, he sees the Zionist movement as absolutely part of the messianic redemption. The Haredim are fighting a desperate rearguard action to preserve what they perceived as what had been their independence under the Ottoman Empire. There were many, many, many battles. There was and again, I respectfully comment, James Diamond commented that he didn't think the relationships between Sonnenfeld and Cook were friendly. I think the relationship changed over time. Certainly, there were many recorded instances of the two of them showing what I would call guarded respect to each other. They participated together in Bris Mila, they participated together in various smachot. Rav Sonnenfeld sent Rav Cook wine and cake on Erev Shabbos on several times, etc. But eventually relationships deteriorated. There were a whole series of areas of conflict. And these conflicts were marked by battles of wall posters, by pamphlets, by horrible defamatory slanging matches. And they centered around, first of all, the basic question of nationalism and religion. The fear of the Haredim was that nationalism had come to replace religion as the dominating ideology of the Jewish community. The fact is that Rav Cook did not wish to replace nationalism, did not wish to replace religion by nationalism. He wished to combine religion and nationalism. He did not see it as an either-or. The whole thrust of his ideology was that Jewish national revival was part of the messianic activity that was a precursor to redemption. That was number one. Number two was the question of sport. Professor Diamond alluded to Rav Cook's famous endorsement of sports, of healthy body, healthy mind. The Haredim seized on this, following the Hanukkah motif. Sport was a Hellenistic pursuit, pagan, alien to Judaism, etc., etc., etc. The languages of drashot. What language would Rav Cook speak when he spoke to the, when he gave public drashot? Would it be Yiddish or would it be Hebrew? He insisted on speaking in Hebrew. The Haredim tried to insist that he should speak in Yiddish. And there were over and over and over and over again football in Jerusalem. There were many, 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 many areas of conflict. And Rav Cook tried to be a peacemaker, tried to be tolerant, tried to see, sometimes under extreme provocation, tried to see the positive in every area. But there were occasionally these things were awful. There was a famous incident, one Purim, I think around about 1927, 28, if I'm not mistaken, when some yeshiva bokrim in Jerusalem on Purim held a mock trial where they had somebody dressed up as Rav Cook and they put him on trial and they pronounced sentence of death four times at the end of the Purim spiel. And this was so embarrassing that even Rav Sonnenfeld apparently went round to Rav Cook to personally apologize, and they sent the Bokhrim involved away from Jerusalem to Hebron, or to Tzfat or Tiberia for a few days until they came back. But the great divide was the establishment of the chief rabbinate in 1926. And this really was the end of relationships between Rav Cook and the Haredi community. Why? For Rav Cook, first of all, it's important to note the establishment of the chief rabbinate of Israel was initiated by the British. The British were, very anxious to impose civilized government on the Jews and the Arabs. They had many headaches. And they saw a system of justice that needed to be regulated. So they proposed the chief rabbinate of Israel on the model, obviously, of the chief rabbinate of England. Not realizing that the civilized Victorians who had established the chief rabbinate in England were very different from the Jerusalem street, shall we say. And interestingly, there were two problems here. Problem number one was that, from the point of view of the Haredim, this was what is known in Jewish history as Rabbanut Mata'am, a tainted rabbinate. Jews of Europe, particularly in Russia, had had terrible experiences where a secular government paid the salaries of rabbis. And these are known in Jewish tradition as the Rabbanut Matam, a tainted rabbinate. How can you have an independent rabbinate if their salaries are paid by, if their paymasters are people who do not share the same value system as the rabbinate itself? And there'd be many unfortunate experiences. And the second was that the architect of the chief rabbinate legislation in Israel was a Jewish lawyer called Norman Bentwich. Bentwiches were an old Anglo-Jewish family. They were instrumental in the founding of the Hebrew University. There is, on the edge of the Hebrew University, a little plot of land. I can't even describe where it is, but I came across it almost by mistake many years ago. Little plot of land, sort of this big, right, this big, which contains all the graves of the Bentwich family, about 8 or 10 of them, buried on Mount Scopus. That's where they wanted to be buried. They negotiated a plot. You can find it. Including there is the burial place of Rosalind Franklin. And anyone who knows the history of the discovery of DNA, she was a niece of the Bentwiches, the great discoverers of DNA were Crick and Watson. Thank you. Crick and Watson. But really, there was an unsung hero, a woman called Rosalind Franklin, who was came from an old Jewish family of brilliant scientists who never got credit for this discovery, and she's buried there as well. So, anyway, so Bentwich designed this legislation, and he incorporated in it what he saw as an inescapable part of any judicial system, which was provision for a court of appeal. Right? A court of appeal. Well, this sent the Haredim completely bananas, because they said there is no precedent in Jewish law, in halakha, for a court of appeal. You cannot have a Bet Din and have above it a court of appeal. For Rav Kook, however, his vision of this, he saw it as a path towards his vision of a universal Sanhedrin. One of Rav Kook's great visions of reestablishing the centrality of the Yeshuv in the land of Israel as the religious center of Jewry was to create a world Sanhedrin. Even recently, it's not an idea that's been totally lost, right? Those of you who keep up with the news will know. But Rav Kook saw this as a wonderful opportunity, because in a way, here was the British government, here was the British mandate, giving him on a plate the opportunity to establish a world Jewish rabbinic authority through the chief rabbinate of the land of Israel. It was impossible to reconcile this, the two sides, despite the fact a delegation of rabbis from Europe was sent to try and make peace. They were unable to do so. In 1926, Rav Kook accepted his appointment as the first chief rabbi of Palestine, as it then was, and that was really the end of relationships between Rav Kook and the Haredi community. However bad they'd been, whatever dialogue there had been or not been, that was it. That was the end. Both Rav Kook and Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, passed away in the early 1930s. Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld in 32 and Rav Kook in 35. And then, again, it's outside the purview of this talk, but everything changed again with the rise of the power of Nazism in Germany. The Palestinian Aguda actually then began to act under pressure from the Aguda in Europe, began to actively support the idea of a Jewish national home. They had some reservations. They wanted a constitution, but they supported the idea of the Jewish national home. Moshe Bloy, there's a fabulous picture of Moshe Bloy at the 1937 roundtable conference at St. James's Palace in England. And there's a photograph of the participants in the conference. And here you have all these sort of stiff upper lip British with their wing collars and the Zionists sort of sitting there in suits and ties. And there at the end of the table is Moshe Bloy representing the Aguda with long silver payers. I mean, he has silver colored, long, long, long silver payers, sitting in his Yerushalmi robe, etc., etc., etc. At this point, the Palestinian Aguda began to split into what you might call the rejectionist front and those who had, albeit a qualified, but a policy of cooperation with the Yeshuv and with the Jewish Agency. At the end of the war, in 1945, a breakaway group from the Eda Haredit formed themselves into the group known as Natori Karta under the leadership of Amram Bloy. But in 1948, the very same Palestinian Aguda, who had opposed, through Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who had opposed Rav Kook and his ideas for 30 years or more, for three decades or more, signed the Declaration of Independence. Reb Itcher Meir Levin was a signatory of the Milchemet Ha'atzmaut, of the Declaration of Independence on behalf of Agudas Yisrael. Something, again, that is not totally publicized by the present-day Aguda histories. Yeah, you know, did he sign it? No, it was a mistake. He thought he was signing it. Anyway, but he signed it. Because they were part of the governing coalition. That's why they were part. They wanted representatives from all the yeshuv to sign the Declaration of Independence. He was with Ben Gurion. The Aguda at that time were partners Ben Gurion. They were in the first government. So the story, as I said, of the relationships between Rav Kook and the old yeshuv of Jerusalem is incredibly complex. It was to a degree a personal battle, but both sides represented, I would say, almost irreconcilable trends and dilemmas within post-emancipation Judaism. Is the modern Jewish community, I'll use Professor Diamond's words, pluralistic? Does it recognize that in the post-emancipation world, the rules are different? Or is it a community that says, our option in the open society is to preserve a pre-modern system of authority and government, and we do not want any part in what is happening? Rav Kook was a brilliant, original, idealist, visionary, a man whose vision, as Professor Diamond indicated, whose vision was in some ways ahead of those who were the subjects of his vision. He lived a life of great pain, both from his opponents in the ultra-Orthodox, intensively Orthodox world, and sometimes a great pain from the failure of the general Zionist movement to come on board with his own personal expectations and aspirations. The old yeshuv of Jerusalem was as much a product of modernity as the modernism that they opposed. They were not a group endowed with historical credibility who had been unchanged. They were as much a product of modernity as those whom they opposed. The battle between them is an interesting, fascinating, often misunderstood and often wrongly described minor battleground in Jewish history. And thank you for your patience.